First Annual Research Symposium on the Late Effects of Poliomyelitis, May 25th to 27th, 1984, held at the Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation, Warm Springs, Georgia. Tape K201-6B, continuation of the presentation, Clinical Management of Partially Innervated Muscles, presenter Gerald Herbison, Normal Aging in Muscle and Trainability in the Elderly, presenter Amalie Anjanson, and keynote addresses by James Roosevelt and Hugh Gallagher.
Chronic severe neuropathy, what Dr. Dalakis is saying is that with a chronic severe neuropathy, one sees evidence of myopathic transformation. The point that I want to make here is that I am not finding evidence of myopathic transformation, and this makes me believe that there is an inhibition of reinnervation. So that perhaps one of the studies that we have to look at is rather than at the muscle directly, what we would have to do is look at evidence for a progression of denervation in these later stages.
Certainly, because this is not chronic.
This is not chronic. But if you take it into the chronic stage, maybe the lack of motor activity causes a retraction of the peripheral sprouts. Okay? Yes, Steve.
Jerry, did you say that you ran these rats at 20 kilometers per hour?
That's right.
That has them running faster than most of our able-bodied runners with long legs.
That is exactly what was brought up before.
I know, but could you be causing muscle damage on the basis of that alone?
The question is, could we be causing muscle damage? And that's exactly the point that I want to make. I didn't find evidence of muscle damage. I found, rather than evidence of muscle damage, I found evidence of lack of reinnervation. All right? Next slide. All right, let me bring up something that was extremely interesting to me. I have a former resident who's in the Philippines, and what she did was take polio patients that were normal, had normal muscles, and another group of patients that had normal strength, but they knew that they had denervation previously. There was another group that had poor to fair strength, another group that had zero to trace strength. She evaluated these individuals for fibrillations, and she found that there was no evidence of any fibrillations in the normal muscles of these post-polio patients. And those individuals that did have weakened muscles in the past, there was tremendous evidence of fibrillations. And in those individuals that just had trace strength, there was about zero to one plus fibrillations. What was fascinating to me was this, that what she did was, because they can do that in the Philippines, they can take their residents, one of their residents and one of their patients, and they forced them to be inactive. And the fibrillations disappeared. They put the person back on activity, and the fibrillations came back again. They put the patients back on inactivity, and the fibrillations disappeared again. Now, again, what does that mean to me, if it is indeed true? And I certainly think it has to be repeated. This is an ideal study for those that have the sophisticated techniques that Dave has. That would suggest that overactivity may produce a chronic affectation of the peripheral sprouts. Now, Ernie is shaking his head. I throw this out only as a hypothesis for you to study. I'm not going to go any further than that, my friend. All right, next slide. All right, so we get back to our original equation right here where we talk about damage related to the intensity of exercise, the time, and the number of motor units. In the electrical stimulation experiment that I showed you, the intensity of activity was very mild, yet the time over which the electrical stimulation was given was fairly prolonged, but I think, as you've indicated, reinnervation occurred so rapidly that damage did not occur in those animals. Indeed, peripheral sprouting may well have been initiated. Let me go on to the next slide. I only have 10 minutes. I'll summarize in a second. So that what we have then is damage then defined a little differently than what I originally thought. I originally thought that damage directly affected the muscle, i.e. taking a look at Drachman's work, taking a look at Van Ling's work, and Reitzba's work. There's now a possibility that perhaps sprouting is inhibited, synaptogenesis may be affected, or there may be synaptic function, as Dr. Weekers has brought out before. Next slide, and then I'll finish here. Because of the fact that tearing the spinal L5 root out of the spinal cord was extremely traumatic to the spinal cord, what I decided to do was cut the roots. We cut L4 and cut it bilaterally, and we cut L5 bilaterally. We had a control group, a normal control group, an L5 control group, I'm sorry, an L4 control group, and an L5 control group. In this group here, there's about 80% denervation, and in this group here, there's about 20% denervation. I might add that there is a tremendous overlap, just as there is in human beings. Okay, next slide. What we evaluated, as you can see, the soleus 1 week after denervation and simultaneously synergistically tenotomized the animals, all right, to produce marked overwork. Next slide. We can evaluate tension, as you can see. Now take a look at the diagram. What you're looking at is the muscle weight here and the tetanic tension here. This is the normal group. This is the normal synergistic tenotomy group. This is the normal group. This is the normal synergistic tenotomy group. How do you interpret that now, Ernie?
I'm still thinking about your mistake about that paper in Philippines.
That's all right. Change gears a little bit. Now, don't get too hung up here. Change gears.
You dropped a very important...
We're going to come back to that.
No, it isn't important at all. It's a mistake.
He threw out a clinical impression that I think is a debatable point.
In lieu of the time, let's forego the Philippine study and proceed on.
And
with
we'll
this.
Move on to this one. You could pick and choose what you like. You see.
Yeah, but those are people, and these are rats.
One more.
We're talking about rats right now. Let's please continue on with this.
All right. Now what we'll do is take a look at something that I do think is extremely important because it's totally relevant to the way that we manage patients. If indeed you take a normal rat and you synergistically tenotomize the soleus and gastrocnemius, you can see in a 1 week period of time there's a tremendous increase in the muscle weight and there's a tremendous increase in the tetanic tension. All right? Tremendous increase. Now, in the L4 group, which as I said before, is generally speaking 20% denervated, you can see that with overwork, again, there is a significant increase in muscle weight and a very modest increase in tension. The significance was, it was insignificant mainly because our standard deviation was so small. But what I want you to do is focus on something that you and I are always dealing with. We're dealing with markedly denervated muscles, and this I certainly would argue much more vehemently about than the fibrillation business, which I have my questions about too. But take a look at what happens when there's tremendous denervation and then synergistic tenotomy is performed. And similarly, take a look at the tension when synergistic tenotomy is performed. Now, Ernie, your mind now is off of the other for a long enough time for you to interpret that. What does that mean to you?
It's bad. Overwork.
Is overwork bad, or are we saying something else here? What does this tell you, Alan? You're still back on fibrillations too, huh?
No,
here you go, I'm sorry.
Let me really try now. Well, I would have to agree with Dr. Johnson. It does look as if the overwork is bad in those muscles which have been partly denervated by removal of the L5. That's the one right at the
right-hand side.
Yes.
Of the diagram.
Yes, and they're putting out less tension per muscle weight than they should as well. So the muscle that is there is actually relatively inefficient mechanically.
It may be inefficient mechanically. Dr. Thomason?
Yeah. Just a second here. I'll be around.
Don't forget that there's 80% denervation in the L5 sectioned animals. In other words, there's 80% denervation in this group.
80% denervation here and 80% denervation here. 20% denervation here.
Well, you did, very simply, you eliminated so much of the nerve that the muscle, that the animal didn't even use the muscle and didn't even exercise when he was running up the treadmill.
No, there's no treadmill. There's no treadmill in this experiment at all. All there is synergistic tenotomy in this. No added activity.
I was going to ask you, have we got in that diagram the difference in weight of this muscle in an animal that does no work after the tenotomy and in an animal that works severely?
All the animals are put in a cage, and one group of animals has had synergistic tenotomy, and the other group has had no synergistic tenotomy. Let me just comment on my interpretation of this. If a muscle is maximally weakened, then an added stimulus of overwork will contribute nothing to further increasing either the muscle weight or the tetanic tension. So we take our patients that have had a spinal cord injury and have weakened upper extremities. We subject them to an exercise program when they're already tremendously weakened. And the question is, does it have any benefit whatsoever? Secondly, if one overworks this process, this individual, early on, are we indeed interfering with reinnervation? Is there something to be said for protecting that nerve until there is adequate peripheral sprouting? Next slide. I'm going to just go on for a couple more minutes. Keep going. I'll tell you when to stop. Keep going. Oh, by that right there. Some people have asked me how I manage my patients. If they want to go out on the Schuylkill River and scull every day with weakened muscles, I discourage it, because it seems to me what we're doing is may be damaging those muscles long term. In other words, the T factor, the time, is expanded to the point where I worry about damage. Next slide. So if they are in a 3-grade range, I limit the amount of activity that they do over a prolonged period of time. That doesn't mean to say if I have a child that wants to go mountain climbing one day that I don't let them do it. It's this chronic activity day after day if they're in some kind of a sports activity. I discourage the gym teacher pushing them to their limit on a daily basis. Next slide. Next slide. Okay, isometrics, next slide. Now, this is one of the best experiments I've ever seen and what I use clinically to manage my patients that are weak. What Mueller did was have old polio patients, late polio patients, contract 6 seconds 3 times a day. And what he found was the following. Next slide. He found that every single one of the patients increased in strength, all right, with brief isometric contractions or brief isotonic contractions. So when we talk glibly about giving an exercise program, we must be very specific in talking about the exercise program that we're going to be prescribing. I have never seen a study that demonstrated that brief contractions performed even once an hour throughout the day ever damaged muscle. Every study that I've ever reviewed, and I've got bundles of them, shows that it is the long term, the prolonged and moderately intense activity that seems to produce the muscle damage. And with that, I will thank you for your tolerance of my rather probing approach to this particular topic. Thank you very much for inviting me.
We're taking a coffee break, and we will reassemble at 11 o'clock. Okay.
The next speaker we're going to work in is not on your program. Dr. Emilio Emerson from Sweden is going to talk to us on normal aging and muscle and trainability in the elderly, which she came prepared to do and seems very pertinent to our discussion to this symposium.
We've given her 10 minutes.
My name is Amelie Anjansson, and I am a medical doctor from the Institute of Rehabilitation Medicine in Göteborg. And I am going to present some results from on muscle function and trainability in elderly. Most of the results is from population-based studies in 70 years old in Göteborg and in 80 years old in Copenhagen. And some of my co-workers is Gunnar Grimby in Göteborg and Bengt Saltin in Copenhagen. So, it's not... So. Can you see it?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
I have to help.
Help.
You help us.
Turn off the slide instruction, please.
You can see, I can hold that. Here you can see that the muscle strength decline about 50% between the age of 20 and 80. It's results from a study by Asmussen and Hebel Nielsen on population-based material in Copenhagen. The decline starts around 50 years of age and starts a little earlier and decline a little more in the legs than the arms. Here I have written that the muscle coordination declines around 40% and between the age of 20 and 80. And it's the coordination in the hand. The endurance in the hand grip didn't change with age. Here you can see that the muscle mass, yes, I have to move it. So muscle mass declines about 30% between the age of 20 and 80. It's from the study by Sankoff and Norris. Why did the muscle mass decline? Yes, we think that there is an important loss of motor units, and EMG studies by Stolberg has confirmed that, and Professor Tomlinson confirmed it yesterday. Is there also a hypertrophy of the fibers? And if there is a hypertrophy, does it involve the fast twitch fibers we use in principally anaerobic work and in high contractions and fast contractions, or does it involve aerobic slow twitch fibers which we use in endurance training and during aerobic work? We have then found that there is a decline in fiber size in the fast twitch fibers, and especially in the type 2B fibers which we use in fast contractions, but not of the ST, the slow fibers. I have investigated the same men at the age of 70 and 75, and I have found that the muscle strength decreased between 10 and 12%. Can you see that? So, 12% in the different velocities, we measure the muscle strength on the cybex. And I also found that the FTB fibers decreased in size with 25%, and the muscle mass in whole body with 6% between the age of 70 and 77. We looked after signs on neuropathic signs as grouping, enclosed fibers, type grouping, and as you can see here, the signs or neuropathic signs were very rare in 70 year olds, but increased in 80 years old. Signs on myopathy, we didn't find any signs, myopathic signs. They were very, very rare. Then we wonder if there was a fiber composition change with age. And we have found a tendency to a relative reduction of the fast twitch fibers, the type 2 fibers, after the age of 75. Lexell and Larson and Selsey has proposed that this happened earlier in life. We have found that the metabolic muscle capacity in elderly is still capable I can't pronounce it, of maintaining a great metabolic flow as that of young men. The capillarization is unchanged with age. We have also done an investigation in women and men with hip fractures, and in biopsies from the first day, the fracture day, in them we also found hypertrophy of the type 2 fibers. This is a normal 70 year olds and normal 80 years olds. And here is around 70 year olds patients with hip fractures and around 80 years old with hip fractures. And there was also a hypertrophy in these patients of the type 2 fibers, and neuropathic and myopathic findings were very rare, even in the around 90-year-old women. We investigated 43 women, and 12 were around 90-year-old. Then we wonder if... we find high correlations between muscle strength and practical function tests, and found it important to know if the elderly was trainable, if the hypertrophy was reversible. And then I had trained 19 women with the average age of 72 twice a week for 40 minutes for 10 months. And I found that the muscle strength in the different velocities increased between 7-13%, and it doesn't increase in the control group. Further, I found that the FTA fiber area, the aerobic capacity increased significantly. The bone density didn't decrease during this 10 months, but decreased in the controls. I have also trained 12 apparently healthy men in these ages, and 3 times a week, 40 minutes each time for 12 weeks. And I found the same results, a muscle strength increase is in the FTA area, in the metabolic capacity and aerobic capacity. And the results from these training studies is that the training results agree in large with that observed in young men. How much it reduced?
How much increase?
On your training program?
In men, it was between 9 and 22% in the different velocities, and in women, 7 to 13%. Then the elderly, we think that the elderly are trainable, and we think that ADL activities as walking, shopping, climbing steps, gardening implies also training in elderly. It was what I haven't more about that, but shall I inform about the polio?
Yes.
Then this autumn we are going to start a study on old polio patients from 1950-55. I think that Professor Holstedt has initiated it. And the investigation involves medical examination, muscle function tests, muscle biopsies, EMG, spirometry, ADL function tests, and also interview about physical activity, life events, and we are going to use the handicap classification according to WHO. Thank you.
We are honored today to have two special guest with us. I'll introduce both of them to you, and one of them is going to speak to us briefly. I'm most grateful for the fact that both of them traveled in not the best of conditions yesterday. One of them spent about 2 or 3 hours on the runway in New York. The other one traveled all the way across the country to be with us this morning, and will be traveling back across the country this afternoon. Like many of y'all will be doing, but we are pleased to first let me introduce Steve Ryan. Steve, if you'll stand up. Steve is secretary of the Roosevelt Warm Springs Foundation, and we're delighted to have Steve with us. I might add, if you haven't already figured it out in the program, the Roosevelt Warm Springs Foundation is the primary financial sponsor for this activity. And we're most pleased to have Mr. James Roosevelt here to speak to us briefly. He is president of the Roosevelt Warm Springs Foundation and has been one of our big supporters and an inspiration to me personally as we've been working on revitalizing the programs here. And at this time, I'm pleased to introduce to you Mr. James Roosevelt. They want me to pin this on, they know it's all right.
Thank you, Ellis, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm delighted to have finally made it late last night, and apologize to you for not having been here for the whole session, because I really would have liked to have been here for the whole session. I just want to tell you what a thrill it is for me always to come back to Warm Springs, number one, because I was here at a very early date, probably longer ago than any of you care to remember, if you remember at all. But I was particularly interested in Dr. Owen. I apologize to you for having, I guess, hastened the end of your talk. I found it fascinating. A couple of things occurred to me. You know, my father was 63 years old when he died. And nobody, I don't think, in the latter years of his life ever gave any thought to the fact that maybe he was suffering from some of the late polio symptoms that are a part of what you're studying. And I've read a lot of books about my father, but I'd like to read one more about whether there were any things of a scientific nature that should have been done that were not done during that period. The other thing I think I remember greatly is the fact that when I first realized that he could walk with his braces, I think you said the braces weighed, that you referred to somebody weighing 10 pounds, or 12 pounds total together. If I remember rightly, my father's braces, when he first started to wear them, which were, of course, made here in Warm Springs, weighed 10 pounds apiece. And I just never could understand how he could walk at all with that. And on top of that, having to click them into place, and if you didn't click them quite right, they would fall down. And as a matter of fact, we went to the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia, and one of them didn't click, and he and I both fell down because he was leaning on one of my arms. So, of course, when he finally, as time went on, got improved braces, I think they got down to weighing not more than 3 pounds or 4 pounds apiece on each leg. But the interesting thing to me is that as time went on, he did exactly what you were talking about this morning. He began to do less and less. You have the pictures of Warm Springs of seeing him swim in the pool down here. They built a pool in the White House specifically so he could swim. And little by little, the pool became less used and less used. And he did less and less of the exercises he was supposed to do. He had less of the, whatever you call them, rubdowns, exercises, the physiotherapist that he should have done. And one, being a curiosity seeker myself, I often wondered whether some of that didn't contribute to what eventually wore him out. I think not in brain power, but in physical power. So I just want to pay my respects to all of you and my thanks to you for coming and starting something which I think will be of tremendous value to many people in our country and outside of our country. The human values, I think, are great. You've attracted, incidentally, a great deal of attention. The first mention that I've ever seen in the Los Angeles Times of Warm Springs, Georgia, took place the other day, thanks to all of you. And I want to wish you a lot of luck, and I hope you will come back next year, because if I can do anything about it, I'm going to try to see to it that we do our little share in making it possible for you to be here. Thank you very, very much for coming.
I would like to introduce this evening's speaker, Mr. Hugh Gallagher. Hugh is a friend of mine, one of those rare persons that turns out to be a lifelong friend. We met back in 1955, so it's been almost 30 years of friendship. But in addition to that, he's also a very remarkable human being with most remarkable credentials for speaking to us this evening. He graduated from Claremont Men's College in California and then was awarded a Marshall Fellowship for 3 years and studied at Oxford University, where he read philosophy, politics, and economics. He is an author and has written a number of widely acclaimed books, one on the United States Senate called Advise and Obstruct, which was a book club selection and also nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. In his many years on Capitol Hill, he worked as the administrative assistant and legislative assistant for a number of well-known senators, the last of whom was Senator Bob Bartlett, the first senator from Alaska. And it was during that time that Hugh both conceived and wrote the bill which was passed by the U.S. Senate, which mandated that all buildings in the United States funded with federal dollars be made accessible to all Americans, regardless of physical ability. That bill was later amended and is popularly known as 504. He is currently president of his own consulting firm in Washington. And most recently, he has completed a book on the life of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a psychobiography which deals with Roosevelt, his polio, and the effect of the polio on his life, his personality, and his career. That book will be published next spring. Tonight he's going to talk to us on FDR and Warm Springs. Hugh Gallagher.
Thank you, Laura. Very warm introduction, and I appreciate it. The program is tonight. I have 15-20 minutes of comments, and then we have 17 snapshots of Franklin Roosevelt in various stages of his handicap, illustrating how he moved about the country as president and as a paraplegic. My remarks are in two parts. I'd like to explain why I think it's important to think of Roosevelt as a paraplegic. And two, I would like to give some of my conclusions about the impact that polio had on Franklin Roosevelt. I myself had polio in 1952 at the age of 20. I was at first completely paralyzed, and I was in an iron lung for 6 weeks. The experience had an immense impact upon my character, personality, attitudes, everything. Today, more than 30 years after the event, I still have periodic nightmares in which I awake shouting for air. I know that I am scarred by polio, in much the same way that a concentration camp survivor is marked for life by his experience. Over the last 30 years, I have met several hundred polios with varying degrees of paralysis, and I have never met one for whom polio was not a, if not the, central shaping event of his life. So this is what puzzles me about the standard biographies of Franklin Roosevelt. In these books, FDR's 7-year struggle with polio receives a chapter. The treatment is always upbeat. FDR's victorious struggle to overcome his handicap, and that's all. The handicap is never mentioned again, which is absurd and unreal. To my certain knowledge, a paralytic handicap affects all relationships, alters attitudes, challenges self-esteem, requires calculation minute by minute to a degree unknown by able-bodied people. I think that to write a book, to write a biography of Jesse Jackson without continuing reference to his blackness, or about Margaret Thatcher without reference to her sex, would be foolish. And yet this is the way the standard biographers treat Franklin Roosevelt. So I'm going to do it a little differently. Roosevelt contracted polio in 21 at the age of 39. In its acute stage, the disease paralyzed his legs, weakened or paralyzed his trunk muscles, and for a short period affected his hands and arms. FDR's hands and arms soon returned to normal strength. Over time, his trunk muscles achieved a very good recovery, but his leg muscles, and most importantly, his gluteus maximus, never did. The degree of paralysis of his leg muscles proved particularly frustrating.
because the muscles were not flail. They had movement, and some had significant strength, but they were not functional in any useful way. For 7 years, Roosevelt's principal interest in life was the recovery of movement for his paralyzed legs. With what seemed an almost maniacal intensity, he devoted the major part of each day, 6 hours or so a day, to this effort. He took all the cures, tried all the devices, he read all the literature, he corresponded with all the doctors, and I am sure that he ended up as one of the best informed specialists on polio of his day. But so far as muscle recovery goes, FDR made little progress. What he did do was develop techniques which allowed him to appear to be less handicapped than, in fact, he was. Using these techniques, FDR was able to re-enter public life. To stand erect and to walk, FDR at first required a pelvic band, a corset, braces, and crutches. In due course, he was able to do without the corset and the band. However, throughout his life, he was dependent upon his braces. Rather than use crutches, FDR devised a system of support which made use of the strong arm of an aide on one side and a full load-bearing cane on the other. This technique for walking was devised for the sake of appearance. It was not in any sense a practical means of locomotion. It was treacherous, slow, and awkward. In fact, it was dangerous. Had he slipped on some wax on the floor with that cane, he would have gone down. It would have been much more sensible to use crutches. With crutches, he could have moved about in a reasonably practical and safe manner. Crutches, however, are a symbol of the cripple. They arouse strong emotions, emotions quite opposite to those a leader would wish to stir. Now, Roosevelt, throughout his political career, projected a supreme confidence and cheerful command, and he couldn't have done that using crutches. At Warm Springs, FDR developed various techniques for coping with his handicap. These were designed to assure him vast public exposure without drawing attention to his physical condition. Here are some of the things he did. FDR saw a vast number of visitors in his office. He and his wife entertained constantly, and the White House was always full of overnight guests from all walks of life and all parts of the country. FDR had twice weekly press conferences seated at his desk in his office. He often broadcast radio messages to the American people. These were not only formal addresses and fireside chats, but short statements, day by day, from week to week. He was able, through these means, to dominate the news media. When Roosevelt did leave the White House, his excursions were very carefully planned by the Secret Service. The White House imposed certain rules that were always obeyed. The president was never lifted in public. If it was necessary to lift him in or out of a car, this was done in the privacy of a garage or, as in many cases, behind a temporary plywood screen specially constructed. He was never seen in public seated in a wheelchair. Either he appeared standing on the arm of an aide or else he was seated in an ordinary chair. He required that the chair be solid enough with arms strong enough to support the full weight, his full weight, as he pushed himself up to a standing position.
This is the end of Side 1. Please turn your tape over now to continue listening on Side 2.